The most famous pot we have in the collection, one cannot go past the ubiquitous pottery. And part of this thing I say about the going into a museum, and probably one of the hardest things is this wonderful red and black figure, or black and red figure pottery that is in museums. Curators love it, they think it's the most extraordinary stuff. Historians, ancient historians, they think, oh, it's wonderful, blah, 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 blah. There's the odd myth here and there. As a visitor, you walk past row upon row upon row of female heads, young chap with a naked woman drinking out of a fist. They can be very dull, some of them though do stand out. And the key is to make these ones that stand out explain why. Now, you mentioned that I came to this as a second career. In fact, my very first tutorial was in the Nicholson Museum back in 1995. This was the first thing that I saw. I'd never been into the museum before. And I'd have to say I was somewhat dumbfounded. My first impression that it was three guys seemed to be in a state of sexual arousal, having decapitated various people. And of course it was explained to me to know that this wasn't actually what's going on. In fact, they're actors in preparation or after the performance of a satyr play. They're carrying, one of them has his mask on the right, and having the mask on, he's already in character, he's doing a bit of a dance. The two in the middle are holding their masks, they're far more complicated. They're then wearing the little satyr shorts, typical for a satyr play, made of leather with a leather phallus attached on the front. The Swingers tells us that in fact this phallus in the front was very often painted red. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is, okay, that's the pot itself. This pot was found in the 1790s by the chap on the right, Sir William Hamilton. The man with three great passions are in his life. One of them we can see through the window at the back there, the Vesuvius. Hamilton, of course, was the ambassador, of the English ambassador, British ambassador in Naples at the court of the King of the Two Sicilies. He was there at the golden time for the Grand Tour between the 1870s through the 1770s through to 1800, when he had to flee with his wife and her lover Napoleon's approach. His second great passion, you can just make out in the cabinet on the right, was Greek pottery. He put together two famous collections of pottery. The first one he sold to the British Museum, and it became the fundamental basis of their collection today. The second collection he sold to a chap I'll come to in just a second. His third great passion, of course, was his wife, the fair Emma, lover of Horatio Nelson. I mean, there is another lecture in itself. But moving on, in 1801, as I say, Hamilton had to flee Naples with Emma and with Nelson in tow, recovering from his wounds. And they're back in London. And Hamilton hadn't been able to sell the second collection he'd got together. And finally, he did. And he sold it to the man on the right, the wonderful Thomas Hope. Hope is an extraordinary chap. He's one of my favourite characters, I think, from this early time. He wrote two books. One was, I will have to, Household Furniture and Interior Decoration in 1807. The other was Costumes of the Ancients in 1809. He was more than just an author, though, because he was also one of the richest men in Europe. He came from a banking family that had been based in the Netherlands, that again had been driven out by the coming of Napoleon, and he'd set himself up in London. He tried to buy his way then into English society, and he never actually did. He was never knighted, even though he did the most extraordinary things, one of which, through his two books on design and household interior and things, was basically that whole concept of the Rigisi style. Enormously influenced, because he got inspiration from the extraordinary collection of antiquities that he had. One of the main collections he had, he bought the second collection that Hamilton had in 1807, two or three, and this again is the basis of his collecting. So this pot on the left, apart from all the things about it, has now been in the collection of two really extraordinary people. Think too, the Hope Diamond. This is the man responsible. Those things I've looked at so far are things that are stories I tell in the 50 Objects, 50 Stories exhibition that's on at the moment, in the book that accompanies it. I'm now looking for the new stories for the next book. And again, it's delving into the collection. It's finding these wonderful stories and collections that resonate. On the pot here is a very nice Attic red figure hydra that we have in the collection. It comes from Vulci, the great Etruscan site, and it's typical of the sort of material, the Greek material, that's finding its way into Etruscan graves in the 5th century BC. It shows a myth, and this myth wasn't actually recognised for a long, long time because the chap in the middle is holding a box. But just in front, you can see very well in this picture, there's a shading of something hanging down from his hand. But it's actually a piece of jewellery, because this is actually the myth of Eriphyle. She's been bribed to betray her husband. It's all about the Seven Against Thebes, the great battle that went on, interfamily trouble. So there's a myth in itself, which is of interest. I quite like this card. And on the market from a bookseller recently down in Melbourne, it's an awful thing that people do. They get the old books, they might be old collections of Hamilton's collection, or Gerhardt, or these people, and they break them up. They take the pictures out and sell them for people to frame those pictures. I bought one. And the one I saw actually had this pot on it. And I thought, well, that's beautiful. It was a line drawing of the pot done in the 1830s, a lovely description of it. It's on a double page photo. It's about this size. And I've had it framed, and it hangs at home. On the same page, with it down the bottom, are two small, lesser pieces. One is a drinking cup, a calyx with two hands inside. The other is a very beautiful little opal, little wine jar. And I was looking at the picture one day, and at the book, as one does, admire it. And I looked at the calyx, and I thought, it's funny. It looks sort of familiar. I've never looked before. And I also thought, well, bugger me. And in fact, I got in the car, it was a Sunday, and I went back into the museum, where, in the case, I have an exhibition on the Etruscans on at the moment, I had two objects that came from Vulci. One was this pot, the other was the calyx. It was exactly the calyx that I have illustrated in the picture I have hanging at home. What's extraordinary, the calyx on the left we acquired in 1953. The one on the right we acquired in 1959. They weren't acquired together, they were acquired from completely different sources. And yet, there they go back to both having been together back in the 1830s, illustrated in this book written by Gerhardt. And the fact that I have the picture hanging on my wall. So it's an extraordinary coincidence of coming together. From 1901 to 1938, a chap called William Woodhouse was curator of Nichols Museum and professor of Greek at the university. A man also that I've been fascinated in because he comes from the Lake District of England as well. There's something about the Lake District and the Nichols Museum. He was one of the first students of the British School at Athens in the late 1880s, 1890s. He was a sixth student there, in fact. He went back to Greece six times, we know exactly when he was there. He took over 1,500 photographs when he was there. Glass plate photographs, they're absolutely exquisite. We were given these by his daughter in the 1980s. They'd been fire damaged. They'd been in the garage of the daughter's house, there'd been a fire. There were soot marks on a lot of them, water got into them. We had them restored. We then started looking at exactly what it was. We didn't know what was in them. We scanned them all and started going through them. I'm just waiting to hear back now if we're going to get a very large grant from the NASA Foundation to put on, to both write a book, I'm working with John Papadopoulos in America on this, and six other scholars around the world, because this collection is so important from the point of view of the archaeology, the architecture, but most importantly for the everyday life of Greece in the 1890s and early 1900s. This is a wonderful picture. The Acropolis in the background on this group of people standing in the front. I've got two pictures to show you, and if I showed you them all, they're just gobsmackingly wonderful. This is fantastic. This is one of my favourite because the second time in Greece, Woodhouse fell ill. He was a sickly young lad. And so who comes to look after him? His mother. His mother, who had never left the little village of Witherslack in the Lake District. A day out in Kendal, shopping, was the highlight of her life. Suddenly, she's on a boat out to Greece. And she's off with her son, just the two of them, going into Aetolia. Because Woodhouse is famous for the work he did in Aetolia. His book, The Topography and Blah 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 of Aetolia, written at the time, is still a standard work on the area. His mother Mary went with him, and we have a whole sequence of the most wonderful photographs. A sequence of them having a picnic with the girls, the Amazone, and these three girls, women, running down the hill towards them. And Nicholson has got the whole sequence. It's almost like a stop grab animation. But this is a wonderful picture. She's taken her hat off and thrown it onto the ground. In all the other pictures, she's wearing a hat tied under her head. She's got her bullet on underneath. I have pictures of her back home in Witherslack wearing exactly this same bonnet. The belt, and it was the belt that enabled us to identify quite specifically. It was this very big belt with a metal buckle at the front. Again, she's wearing in nearly every picture we have of her back home in Witherslack. So here it is. This is his mother travelling with him up in the mountains, heading over towards Delphi and on into Aetolia. It's intriguing that they're having to travel with the guards, the Exone. It's very intriguing that the chap in the middle there, very preparatorily, has got his hand up there, not resting on her leg. I mean, but it was a very dangerous time as well. The traveling was only a couple of years before this, and there'd been a very famous massacre, murder of some French and English tourists travelling up towards Evia. And this had become a real cause célèbre in Greece at the time. So these were dangerous times. This was a dangerous time to be off doing this. But again, we look at the costumes they're wearing, and it's just too fantastic. Now I bring you back to deeply boring things, you know, relatively speaking. A very nice standard Etruscan Bucchero jug, 7th century, on provenance. I mean, how many objects in museums from antiquity actually have a provenance? It was donated in 2012. Thank you very much. It was acquired on the art markets, and we do have actual paperwork to prove that it was acquired before, in the right time. Anyway, okay, I probably have in the collection 12, 13 of these jugs, of these Olpis. However, it was donated by Margaret Olley. Okay. This makes it a little bit more interesting. Together with a tube of paint that was inside the jug when we actually took delivery, including a couple of paint spots on the top of the jug. Our concern is, oh my God, let's get that paint off. No way. Those paint spots stay on that jug for all time. And in fact, the tube of red paint has actually been accessioned and is now part of our collection. But what becomes very interesting is that it appears, as far as I know at the moment, in four of her pages as a flower vase. So here we have exactly the joke, and here it is. And this suddenly, we're getting into a whole different thing. Because in fact, for the exhibition next year, I've already spoken to the trustees, and we're looking to get the painting or one of the others to be on display in the museum with the jug. And the story continues in our latest edition of our museum's magazine. It's on the cover. The story is inside Great Australian's Gift, a Masterstroke for Museum. Okay? So what on the surface is a very mundane, ordinary Etruscan book or a jug with no problems whatsoever. We do not know where it comes from, which is the great tragedy of it. It's this later story that is giving the object life and a purpose and an accessibility. And that's what is so important. Near in the end, a love story. We all like a good love story, and this is an absolute beauty. On the right, I have the wonderful Grace Jones. On the left, Max LePettit. Max, again, was a slightly sickly young man. He was assistant curator of the Nicholson Museum during the Second World War. He worked with Dale Trendle, who was curator of the museum at the time. They got engaged, they fell in love. A wonderful story. Gwyneth used to go in and sit with Max. She'd sit on the door when the museum was open and talk to people as they came in. Absolutely endearing. Tragically though, in 1947, Max died. And again, I didn't know it. In my first year of archaeology, I won the Max LePettit Memorial Prize for Archaeology. I had no clue who Max LePettit was, which is he. And what's wonderful is that Trendle organised, in memory of Max, the acquisition of the antique white man Lepithos that we have at the back there, by the Thanatos painter, the deaf painter. So it's a rather wonderful conjunction. But why the slide? Why the object at the front? Because Max had a friend, a soldier, who'd been over in Egypt, and during the war came back, as soldiers did at that time, with little bits of Egyptian ephemera, little scarabs, little amulets, all sorts of bits and pieces that they'd been sold. And he gave the scarab, this lovely little scarab, he gave it to Rome. This was during the war, okay? And funds were very low. She had a friend who was a dentist. Good story, this. Silver was very expensive. How are they going to get a ring to mount this particular scarab? Well, they took a 2 shilling piece and melted it down, which in itself, of course, was highly illegal. But they actually used this to actually create the ring. Gwyneth wore it until, through arthritis, her hands couldn't wear it anymore and took it off. She donated the ring and a couple of other tiny little objects to the museum. She came one day, she's the most unassuming woman. She's not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but her whole love of the museum, because she never married. Max had been her one true great love. Again, she's still alive today, and it sort of makes me almost tearful thinking about it, because she is the most fantastic woman. And this was actually at the opening of an exhibition we had called Beauty and Betrayal, which was an exhibition on jewellery. That ring, together with Lepithos, were one of the objects, the display objects, that we actually had in the exhibition on ancient and modern influence jewellery. Gwyneth approached me 18 months ago and said that she would like to give me some money in honour of Max. Well, we already have the Max LePettit Memorial Prize through a fund set up by his parents when he died. And Gwyneth gave me $10,000. And this would be just about her life savings. And we created, I said, no, we can't do that in that area. Max was graduating memory for two of you. So we set up the Max Repetit and Gwyneth Jones Memorial Prize, which is now offered to undergraduate honours students for an essay written or tutorial, a piece of work involving an object in the Nicholson Museum. And I'm just waiting at the moment for this year's input to come in. So again, a wonderful story, but it all came out of this love for somebody in the past for the museum and the connections that have been followed through and come through. Great story. And then I have to finish with the great monster. The great Lego Colosseum. Some of you might know, and I'm sure many of you don't know, that last year, in July last year, we had built for us the largest ever model made of the Colosseum in Lego. A quarter of a million bricks went into building this. I had the idea, and in fact I was mentioning in this morning, the idea for this came directly to a contact I had on Twitter. So this is an exhibition, this is a monster that has been created by Twitter. And I ran up Lego and I said, I want to build a Lego Colosseum, how do I do it? And they said, well look, you need to speak to a Lego professional. Where are they? How do I find them? There are only 13 in the world. Are there any in Australia? Yes, one. Down in Melbourne. Ryan McNaught, the Brickman. And so I contacted Ryan and we spoke about this and got Toby and we agreed the price and we paid for it. We only did cost the same as a small house in Armadale or whatever. And the whole question of how to design, what we did, we did in section, cut it down the middle, we've done half as it was, supposedly, and half as it is now, the ruin. We included things like the Arch of Constantine. We've got the Fountain of Vespasian in the front row. It is not authentic for those peasants out there who might think, hey, that's not right, it should be another arch out there. It's Lego for Christ's sake. But, and the arguments I had at the university to try and get this through, you know, you can't do it, it's not tricky. I had to argue that in the 1700s, models were being built out of cork of the great models of the ancient world. Then they were made out of plaster. Lego is simply the model making material par excellence of today. There is hardly a person today who has not played with Lego growing up, who does not have children or grandchildren, who adore the stuff. We put on the exhibition, we imagine that, you know, we're going to hit 100,000 visitors this year. Part of it is due to the Lego monster, because the amount of people, we have had tens of thousands of extra visitors who have come in to quite specifically see the Lego Colosseum. It came down, the exhibition in July. It's currently on tour around your New South Wales. It's in Broken Hill at the moment. Yes, the Romans got to Broken Hill. It's going to Bathurst, it's going to Newcastle, it's going to Tamworth, and it's going down to Auburn over the next 3 years. So again, we're getting our money back at least for doing it, for creating it. But of course, my challenge was, why stop with the Colosseum? And in July this year, I should show you first the inside of the model. And as you can see there in section, we have over on the right, it as it was, and over here we have the ruin, we have tourists, we have all sorts of things going on, restorations. Down here, of course, we have the Pope-mobile, visitor, and one of the things that, of course, with this is to the need to include humour in the whole thing. It cannot be straight-laced thing. The Pope is not in the Pope-mobile. Darth Vader is in the Pope. In case anybody gets upset about it, I have in my desk drawer a Pope that I can put in it. So, and again, we have things going on. The Emperor's over there. There's a bear reaching up. The Emperor's leaning over with a pork chop to give to him. So, there's humour in this to appeal to people to get out. But as I say, why stop there? Why stop there indeed? This indeed is pretty typical of the sort of crowds that we were getting in on weekends and so on to see the Colosseum. It was absolute bedlam. As a result, we set up a shop. We never had a museum shop before, but because in the other museum, we had a very small foyer. Thought I'd heck with it, we were going to start a shop. The shop now, having begun 12 months ago, has taken over $120,000 so far. All of the profits are going back into the museum, because these are the sort of people who like to buy things in museum shops.
So as I say, why stop there when you can create
Lego Acropolis? And the Lego Acropolis went on display a couple of months ago at the beginning of July. Now, we did learn something from Lego Colosseum, and that was the need to incorporate vignettes into it. We didn't do that. We didn't have, a gladiator, what's the name from Gladiator? We didn't have these sort of things happening.
And we learned this time, and the best fun coming up with
ideas for what we could incorporate. We have many. Down bottom left here, we have, of course, Diogenes in his battle with Alexander the Great. And we have numbers, we have sheets, it explains all these things to visitors. They can see exactly what's going on. Up the top in the theatre, in the Odeon of Herodes Atticus, Elton John. He performed there in 2000. Over on the right here, in the Theatre of Dionysus, we have a performance of Oedipus Rex, with Lego blood on the stage. There's Oedipus stabbing his eyes out, Jocasta meanwhile is lying dead on the stage. All right, yes, no, she hangs herself, but she's stabbed there on the stage. We thought maybe it might be a little too literal. And of course, a little known fact down the bottom right. Tolkien always meant it to be Gandalf the Grey. It was an editorial mistake that made him Gandalf the Grey. So, of course, Gandalf. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't know that Ryan was going to include Gandalf in it, and having included it, I had to try and work out a way of justifying why on earth
Gandalf is there. So that's why. So now you know why it's Gandalf the Grey. Agatha Christie, of course, is there. This wonderful, iconic picture.
And going back to, I guess, where I began, with Agatha Christie there, Nimrod, Fortune, these are cleaning her ivories and her poor old face. This is, it's a fantastic picture, this, of her up on the Acropolis.
And, of course, what do we do?
There she is in Lego. Unfortunately, she couldn't find a Lego hat, but she's got her bag, she's got her brolly. And of course, who's taking the photograph of her? Well, let me down. It's William Woodhouse.
There he is with his camera and his tripod.
2 weeks ago, and some of you might think, and you'd probably be fairly justified, thinking, what on earth has Lego got to do with a museum of antiquities? The great thing is, you saw those people swarming in. Purposely, the model is at the back of the museum. They have to walk through all the antiquities to get there. They are exposed to money, they're exposed to the pottery. They will never, ever, ever, I promise you, forget the experience of the day they went to see the Lego Colosseum, Lego Acropolis. Well, I should have. We've got Lego Pompeii coming next year. And so this is my justification for doing it. Well, now, is it worth it? Should we be doing it? 2 weeks ago, I got an email. In fact, almost the middle of the night, I was lying in bed, from a girl called Nikki Dollis. And she said, dear Michael, I've been hearing the most extraordinary things about the Lego Acropolis, and I'm wondering if you might consider lending it to us. Nikki Dollis, I wonder where she works. Well, would you believe the Acropolis Museum in Athens? I was absolutely blown away by this. A, the fact that they'd heard about what we were doing, but B, the fact that the Acropolis Museum, they're wanting to engage with a younger audience. They'd heard what we're doing and they want a part of it. Okay? And I thought about this and spoke with Betty the next day. We're not going to lend it to them, we're going to give it to them. And in fact, they're going to pay to ship it over, we are giving it to them. You know, the British Museum won't give back the Albion Marbles. We're giving it to them. And I can promise you, the mileage, the PR, the everything that we will get out of doing this will be absolutely massive. And I guess, it's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make the Metals Museum known around the world. Again, as I said to you today, one of the things I used to hear all the time when I took over was, you're at the Nicholson. Why don't you see these best kept secrets? As if that was something to be proud of. I detested it when I heard people say that. I didn't want it to be a secret. I didn't want to be best kept. I wanted everybody to know about the Nicholson Museum, where it was, what we've got, and so on and so forth, and the extraordinary stories that we've got to enable all this to happen. And really, that's what I guess I'm all about with what I'm doing. And the other side is, it is the best fun in the world. So, thank you very much. There's always something to find with. I'm sorry. But let me talk again. I was thinking, have I not signed it again? Of course I have. Because what else have we got in there? It's Lord Elgin. In his pith habit. And of course, this is the side I should have been using to tell you about it going back. There he is with his band of marauders. And over here on the right, there they are, removing the marbles.